Yeah, that's right. I always run to the convenience of the airport. I run to Demerara, Denver. It's like usually it's like a hub city. It's like Denver or Chicago. You always run into people. They're running for planes. You're running for planes. I ran into Monroe Martin, like, you know, in Nashville. You know, you always run to the convenience airport.
I ran into I saw that Kevin Nealon.
Yeah, I do his golf tournament.
I saw he was in Arizona. No, he was coming. Yeah, we were catching different flights. Who else have I seen before?
Foxworthy, huh?
Earthquake.
He lives across the street from me. I used to. I haven't seen him, but he lives right across the street from me. I always say, Earthquake, what's up?
Terrible.
I'm off my. I'm usually on my balcony. He's on his balcony, you know.
What's up, fool? What's up, fool? Podcast with Felipe Esparza and Rodrigo Torres.
Yeah, man.
What's up, fool? You got a show coming up.
Chilling, dude. Friday, 8:15 p.m.
We have a surprise for you, bro.
What happened?
I don't know if I'm here yet.
Ice House, Stage 2, 8:15 with Swing of Chile, Armando Cusillo, Juan Garcia, and myself. Yeah, man. Stage 2, Ice House. What happened?
We got you a surprise. It's not here yet, but we got you Yemen shirts for your show on.
Tight,
on
and we're going to have some fucking Yeah Man shirts.
Yeah, man.
So shirt. Come out, man. Support, man.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, man.
It'll be the only time you'll see Yeah Man shirts. Exclusively. 60 made.
That's it, man.
About 60 made, medium. What size is? Medium to 2X.
Hell yeah, man. Thank you guys very much on the real, man. Thank you for everything.
And that'll be your cut.
Right here, we got to talk to the accountants. Divvy
if you
up
ever
the
want
divs.
More t-shirts, of course, it'll be a deal made by now.
Yeah, man.
There'll be 60 t-shirts.
Yeah,
that's
you,
it,
man.
People. He got merch. Rodrigo's first ever merch. Yeah, man. Yeah, man. T-shirts. I think there's a podcast logo on the back of the t-shirt, but the front says, Yeah, man. And Rodrigo's name is on the bottom of the t-shirt. Yeah, Rodrigo Torres.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, your Twitter will be on the bottom.
You so. Heard it here, man. What's
you hear
that
it here,
podcast?
Fool. Tell Chepo, bro. Don't bring no fucking merch, bro.
Can I sell my CD?
All right, man. Before we start, man, your dates on Saturday. And
yeah.
We're going to introduce Jimmy Schubert right now. But
hell yeah.
Do you have any dates you want to plug, Jimmy Schubert?
You know what, man? I'm just taking this month. I finally, like, you know, I have not stopped working since I came off last Comic Stand.
All right.
I mean, you
man.
Know. But
busy,
you know,
dog.
I mean, you literally, I mean, it's been like a year. And I feel like I got a job laying brick every week, man. Every week. I got three corporate dates that are like one, like I got one coming this Saturday. I got one at the end of the month where you were talking about that fan, Alonzo Bowden. And I just was like, that's it. That's all I want to do for August. And September, the same thing. I just want to slow down. I want to concentrate on in-town stuff. So I got a
podcast?
Yeah, I have a podcast, but I stopped doing it just because I haven't been here. It's possible to do. I can only be so many places at one time. But I think I'm going to pick up the mantle again and start doing it. Because
the mantle, Rasa.
Yeah. Get back in there and start flapping my cake hole into a microphone. Everybody's doing it. All the kids my age are doing it. So I figured I might as well. Kids today with your podcast. And your weird math and your information superhighway. Back when I started doing comedy, we didn't have jokes. We had to jump in the audience and tickle people. No, it's all good. Yeah, this is so many. Like, it's so funny because, you know, when I started doing this, I mean, it was just enough to worry about being funny.
Yeah.
And doing the jokes. And now, like, with social media, I mean, it's like a full-time job. I mean, you got to get up every day. You got to go, I'm going to do an hour of social media stuff. I write some jokes for social media. I got to put up my tour dates and do my stuff on my website.
Hell yeah.
I got to do that. I got to write some jokes for my act. You got other people's podcasts you're doing. You got to figure out your own podcast. It's I don't know who ruined it. It used to be a great job. You could sleep till 12, get up, fart, burp, go back. Back to bed, get
those,
some
those
lunch.
Those were the good old days.
Yeah.
That was my first comedy business card said, it read on the bottom, please do not call me before noon.
No business, baby. Yeah, one of my business cards, one of my first business cards said, set up punchlines, callbacks, solid stand-up comedy.
You know, solid.
Well, you know, So I'm doing that casino date at the end of the month. I think it's the 31st of August with, Dat Fan, Alonzo. I think John Heffron's like, you're doing it.
Yeah.
So that'll be a monster show. That's going to be a monster show. Plus it's great to work with Alonzo and yourself. I happen to be, not only do you do comedy, but I happen to be a fan of comedy. I love watching guys do it. that do it. Like, you know, I just watched Jimmy Norton's Netflix special last night. I mean, you watch, you watch guys do it. You go, it keeps you working, man. It keeps you, it's like everybody's writing a new hour every year. I mean, some guys should take a little longer than a year to really flesh it out.
Yeah.
But it's at that pace. It's like kind of, you know, you got to keep doing it. I mean, I just finished working on an hour myself. I'm getting ready to do a Netflix special. We were supposed to tape in September, but they had problems with the venue. They had to back
Nashville?
Out. I was going to do Nashville, yeah.
Yeah, so was Joe Diaz.
Yeah, they
what happened?
Well, here's what happened, man. They had problems with the venue. They don't have any air conditioning.
Oh, you know, and it was hot back then.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's like you're going to Nashville in August. You don't have air conditioning.
A fucking
you better
oven.
Recognize it's going to be hot. I mean, you know, how do you keep you? First off, the theater seats about 288, and with the camera kills is about 250, which is no big deal. I mean, that's a nice little kind of old theater. It was like 1966. It's got a kind of cool little vibe to it. I've been there. I checked it out, but you can't have, you got to have air conditioning because the camera equipment's going to be hot. I mean, you'll be up there sweating and it'll look like garbage. You can't have it. You got to have, and the venue, you know, they had problems in August, so they moved it back to September. And then a couple other people pulled out and the guy that was producing it said, you know what? Give me my money back. I'm pulling out too, unless you guys can guarantee me that there's going to be air conditioning. I don't blame them because it's a lot of money to spend. You're out there spending a lot of money to do these things and we're talking about air conditioning. You know what I mean? I mean, it's so they pushed him back. He's going to regroup, and we're going to do him eventually. I will figure it out, you know. But yeah, we're supposed to. I'm supposed to do him with Diaz and Steve Simone and a couple guys. But you know, things happen in show business. You got to improvise.
Air conditioning, bro.
Hell yeah! Call the Maytag, Manny.
That's funny. Yeah. Man. You send a deposit down for the theater.
$46,000.
Damn!
Now he figured they could use that money to fix the air conditioning.
Now, that's funny when we now. We did a movie called I'm Not Like That Anymore. It was based on my stand-up comedy.
Right.
It went straight to iTunes.
Right.
Yeah, and we had a premiere at the Ricardo Montalban Theater. Paul Rodriguez played my father. You know, it was just a little a little showing just for us. We had a lot of people there. It was packed. Their tape runner.
Their projector?
The projector broke.
Oh, wow.
Halfway through, huh?
And I was like, you guys have another one? No. Well, you know, anything else? So the movie had stopped halfway. Nobody got to see the ending.
Damn.
That's crazy. I mean, you're in that business.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, you know, at your comedy club, you go, hey, your microphone's not working. You got another microphone? Yeah, I have another microphone. It's a simple, basic thing, you know? Little basic things. Doesn't take much to run a comedy show. You need lights. You need somewhere where everybody can look at you and a working microphone. It's pretty simple.
I remember they canceled a gig on me in Chicago and That club over there in Chicago, North Chicago, not Zany, but the one
in
Riddles. And the guy
Park.
Said that, our kitchen just turned broke. We have nothing. We have no food. We can't cook. So the show has to be canceled. I'm going to cancel you.
That's ridiculous.
Go get White Castle, dog.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a White Castle right across the street, man. Order burger, order pizzas.
I have some pizzas coming.
Make a deal with a restaurant. You know people.
Yeah. Dog.
That's a ridiculous reason to cancel a show. Yeah, that's not a you know, an act of God, weather, I get, you know.
Nobody showed
earthquake,
up.
Earthquake, you know, something like that.
A blizzard.
Only your two followers showed up to the show, you know, that.
Your two Twitter followers showed up. They drove in from Wisconsin down there to Chicago.
That's usually what happens. Like, you get the hardcore fans there, the hardcore ones. Oh,
the homemade
man.
T-shirt.
So you're from Wisconsin? Nah, Mac, I drove in from Indiana, man.
Far.
Yeah, I've had people drive in.
I make a bus for this.
Well, show, you know, the funny part, because that's why I never, like, people always go, man, how can you, like, you go work hard. So I go, yeah, I work hard on stage because you never know. People come, they drive distances to come see your show. I don't care if there's 4 people or 10 people or whatever. And it hasn't been like that lately, but I mean, you know, I used to do the old Laugh Factory, you know, going on, like, you know, I mean, this is way back before he did the expansion, back before he had a liquor license. He used to sell Zimas and bottles of water.
No,
he used to, for the burritos.
And it used to be a Chinese place next to it, but back in the LA Cabaret days, I was like, you know, you go up and, there's even 4 people, 5 people. Chrissy Francis's L.A. Comedy Room. They used to be, like, you know, doing those shows late.
L.A. Cabaret was in Balboa in the Valley, right?
Yeah. And they had 2 rooms.
They had 2 rooms and they were both empty. And then I remember doing a big room one time on Thanksgiving Day. It was a black show, and there was like 35 people there.
Yeah, that's so funny that you. I mean, people forget. Like, I remember when, like, in L.A. when I got here, it was like 85, 86, and I had done comedy for a couple of years in Philly, and you could like, you know, and I kind of just, I used to go to the Natural Fudge. You know, like
I started there.
That's right. That's what I'm saying. Like just a natural, yeah, like the Natural Fudge.
On Monday nights.
So, yeah, Monday nights. Me and Newell's Levesey, we would go. With
Brenda Roberts. Yeah. And Johnny Roberts.
Yeah, we would go to.
I'm a Virtual TV kid.
Yeah, yeah, we would do the Natural Fudge. Then we'd shoot over to Monty's Steakhouse in Westwood. And you go up there. It was on the top floor. And then you go do that. And then you could finish your gig. You drive down the Alley Cat Bistro in Culver City. And you shoot up to the Comedy Store. There used to be a Silver Screen Jazz Room right next to the Comedy Store. I used to do a comedy room there. On a Monday night, and then you can get to the Comedy Store on Monday night and do a late night spot. And the first night I did 5 like 20 minute spot, like 15 20 minute spots. I was like, yeah, I didn't feel like an open micer anymore. I felt like I was a real professional comedian. But that's all I cared about, was doing stand up. I mean I worked my day job to pay my bills, and then it was out, and I was out till like 2 a.m. just running and gunning and doing stand up comedy. I would do my spot, run to the next place, do a spot. That's all I cared about. I didn't care about anything else. And if you're trying to like, you know, I don't know that you could do that now because everybody's got bringer rooms and stuff that. And I tell you, like, I've seen like other cities, you know, they really encourage like the second string. They encourage the third string. They encourage these open mic guys because they're going to be the guys coming up, you know, that you got to have a second and third string. They don't do that here in Los Angeles. They really don't encourage talent. And I guess there's so many people doing it, they can't. But, I mean, back in the day, I got to tell you, we used to hustle, man. We used to hustle, me and Noodle, and he would sit in the back and take notes on my act. I'd sit in the back, take notes on his act. We'd jump in the car, drive to the next place. I mean, it was different. It was a kind of camaraderie, you know, and it was different. And then we go, and of course, you're at the Comedy Store, you're watching Richard Pryor, you're watching Robin Williams. I used to watch
Sam Kinison.
Sam Kinison. I toured with Kinison for like 5 years, man.
No, that was like comedy,
yeah,
right?
Dude, that was insanity. I felt like I was a member of a rock and roll band. You know what I mean?
Oh, badass.
But you're on a bus. You're doing 70 cities. You're hanging out with Kinison. You know, he was the most controversial comedian in America at the time, and he had a band closing the show. I mean, he really went in with a full show. He had 4 guys opening up for him, you know, the Outlaws of Comedy. And you're getting to play all these great little theater venues, and a lot of them, like the Cincinnati, like, you know, the Soul Cooties. And I always would love to see who played the theater, you know. I like
8x10s and
yeah, all that 8x10s, and there's a Chicago theater and stuff like that. Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, and all, you see all these guys that played the theater. It's like kind of like, you know. But that's really kind of where I kind of formed my developed in front of those large audiences, you know. And you're watching a guy like Kinison, and you know, they would help you with stuff. They would go, hey, you know, on that joke, don't do it like that. Do it like this. And, you know, give that joke an extra minute because the laugh's going to go out. It's going to come back. I mean, I did the Universal Amphitheater. We did a Universal Amphitheater. Then we went to the Van Nuys Airport, jumped on Learjets, flew to Vegas, and then we did it like a 3 a.m. in the morning show. And it was insanity.
That's,
I mean,
badass, huh?
No, I mean, that's like, I mean, you know, and Sam Kinison was doing the whole Outlaws of Comedy thing. He did it before they did the Kings of Comedy, before they did the Blue Collar Comedy Tour. I mean, Sam was the first guy to bring a bunch of guys on the road with him like that. So that kind of idea, I mean, you know, the Rat Pack guys used to do that too. So it wasn't his idea, but he kind of brought it
to comedy.
Yeah, he kind of brought it back. And yeah, but now, you know, I mean, you look at Jeff Foxworthy did with the Blue Collar guys. I mean, all those guys became huge in their own right. I mean, that's amazing. Like, I mean, and I don't know who the comedian's name is. There's a comedian who used to MC that show, and he used to bust Jeff Foxworthy's balls before he was going on stage. Hey, can I get that $35 for the taxi that I took from the airport? And Jeff Foxworthy's getting ready to go on stage. He goes, are you serious? You kidding me? And he kept doing it to him, and he finally fired the guy, and he got Larry the Cable, and he got Larry the Cable Guy, and Larry the Cable Guy was hosting it, and he quickly wound up headlining it. And all those guys, I mean, I think Ron White was pretty much kind of like done, and you know, and Bill Langville, all those guys. I mean, see, that's the kind of cool thing when a guy like Jeff Foxworthy, who's so secure in his talent and ability, takes some dudes under his wing, and they all become huge in their own right, and they all have guys opening for him and helping him out too. I mean, that's the way it used to. I remember it used to be. It seems like everybody's in competition with each other right now. You know, it's weird. It's, you know, there's enough room for everybody, I think.
There's some cutthroats out there.
Everybody wants to outfollow each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There's enough room for everybody. There's enough room for everybody.
Hell yeah.
Whether you have 100 followers or 100,000, there's room for everybody.
It really is. I mean, it's like golf. You know, I'm not competing against the guys I'm playing with. I'm seeing how well I can play the game. I got enough things to worry about, you know.
You play a lot of golf when you're on the road?
You know, I'm not as much on the road as I used to, you know, because I used to do these creative gigs, like the creative entertainment gigs, where you were doing like, you would do like a Friday and Saturday in like Greensboro, and then you drive, you know, you got to go do Prestonburg, Kentucky on a Wednesday, and you know, Cedar Bluff, Virginia on a Thursday, and then you got to go down to Knoxville on a Friday, Saturday, and I was in my car. I was like doing 1,000 miles a week on my car. I felt like a trucker, but I had my clubs in the back just in case you had a day off and you pull over and just go play golf. Kill an afternoon, but yeah, not so much. I like to play out here. I don't like to lug my clubs with me now because you got merch and stuff you're lugging. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's more of a business thing than, you know, I did recently though in June. I brought my clubs. I was doing a golf outing for a buddy of mine named Steve Azar, who does it's called the Delta Soul. They raise a lot of money for like kids to help them learn music and write music and stuff. And then I went to Philadelphia, played with my brother. So I brought my sticks, and then I went up to Canada and wound up playing 3 days with my buddy Rick Bronson up there at his club. So yeah, it's once in a while I'll do it, but not all the time. I really care. It's more about business, and I've been working on this new hour, so I've just been. It's all about the comedy at this point.
What's up, fool? Jimmy Schubert, man.
Hell yeah!
Season 8 finalist, our last comic standing. What was that like? Because I know what it would be like for me.
Well,
did you have to write down all your jokes and submit them to?
Yeah, I mean, you had to do it.
And a guy who doesn't know anything about funny was reading them and scratching them out. Huh?
Yeah, well, you know,
a lawyer.
Well, you know, that's why the show. I mean, I've seen a couple. I've seen it this time, like last season. They actually had it in theaters. They hadn't done the show in 3 years. They brought the show back.
Yeah.
They had Russell Peters, who I got mad love for. They got Russell Peters and. Roseanne and Keenan and the judges you can respect that have actually done it,
yeah.
You know, you know, so yeah, it's interesting, man. It's high, you've done it. It's high pressure, man. I mean, it's one thing to do it when you're doing it for fun, and now they got cameras in your face before you go on, after you come on, you got to submit your jokes and, you know, yeah. No product names. You got to figure out how to do the joke. And really, you get 4 minutes and 30 seconds. I mean, you're talking about precision. You're talking about a little precision piece of comedy because it's like, I got 4 minutes of every word and every joke's got to count. So it really kind of got me trimming down like bits down to like 4 minutes and 30 seconds. And I work like kind of in a comedic short story form. I like to go up and just talk about one topic and then beat it to death, you know. And so you're boom, boom, and then but it was fun, man. It was fun to do that. And as soon as I came off the show, I started like, you know, letting the bits breathe and I did. I was doing new bits. I was doing new bits on this show that I hadn't done. I got bothered with network television. I'm going out with new bits about getting dumped via text message. Cause I didn't want to do, I could have done, you know, stuff that you've done for years. And I just thought that, like, you know, but, and of course, you know, if you go deep into the competition, you're going to have to tap into it. But I thought that I had some funnier stuff. I thought there's something that everybody could relate to, getting dumped via text message, you know, getting thumb dumped. And I wrote a whole bit about it. I thought it was great, but you know, they were doing them in these venues, like they did the Comedy Store, they did the Improv, you know, and I, like, the audiences of the Improv for some reason, I don't know, they get a little stiff. They're a little stiff. It's not like the Ice House. It's not like Flappers. I mean, Flappers in the Ice House and the Comedy Store, really, they got the best audiences. I mean, they're just working class, you know, blue collar people that just want to laugh. And I love those audiences. That's my crowd. But you get the Improv, they get a little, I don't know, they get a little hoity-toity. And unfortunately, that's where they held the competition. They got voted off the show. But who cares, man? I had a blast doing it. It was fun to be part of it. You know, I made the top 10, which is all I really wanted to do. I did not want to make top 5. I did not want to go on that tour in that bus with a broken toilet, you know.
And a broken toilet?
How
was that tour?
I heard 3 days in, someone broke the toilet. So there was no toilet on the bus. And they weren't even getting them hotel rooms.
No.
They were sleeping on the bus. They had to shower at the venues to get ready for the shows. And they had to get on the bus and drive. I mean, somebody made a lot of money, but it was not the comedians. You know, and you're coming off the show when you're at your hottest, and then you're committed to a 50-city tour. So, you know, I get it. It's become like, you know, it's a business thing. You know, I don't know if you guys went out and did your own tour, you had to do the tour the last
time. No, last time I did a tour, we did 80 shows.
You did 80 shows.
Yeah.
And it's enough to make you snap.
Yeah, those guys wasn't a snap.
Thank God you can finish the tour. You got a callus on the roof of your mouth from a loaded revolver going, okay, I got to get off the tour.
And those guys were getting a lot of shows, like, They were turning down shows during the tour they couldn't do because they were committed to the tour. They were getting upset because they were making so little money
yeah.
on the tour. And they were being offered like 3 times what they were getting on that show to do one show next door, but they couldn't do it for the next 60 or 90 days.
Yeah, that's the problem. I mean, that's the problem.
You couldn't go back to Dallas.
No, and that's the problem is that, you know, once you do that, and that, I guess that's part of, you know, there's a trade out for that, but I just, like you said, I mean, what I did was I grabbed a very funny female comedian named Zainab Johnson, who was a semifinalist. I thought she should have made the finals, but she didn't. But she was 6 foot tall. She's got a shaved head.
Oh, the black girl.
Yeah. Zainab. Me and her just went out. I took her out to feature with me on the road, and we were packing out plays. It was like a mini kind of Last Comic Standing thing. I was out there selling out. I mean, you know, we were selling out joints. I was hitting bonuses. It was my first time in my career, and I was
what's up, boy?
Yeah, that's right. I'm a selling out joints.
Respect.
And I'm going
to. They're giving me a suite now?
Yeah.
Hey, guess what? They gave me. I have press now.
Yeah, I got press. I can leave my shoes outside and someone would shine them for me and bring them back. It was like, you know, you get the, you know, you got that, like some of those, you know, it's nice because, you know, you do this for a long time. Well, you know, the thing I did like about Last Comic Standing, the way they did it was not pretending now. I mean, you want to spend 12 hours on the sidewalk sleeping between a guy in a chicken outfit and a duck costume to get your break in show business. You know what I mean? Because they used to do it like you're going competing against all these jackasses and you're going, look, I've been doing this for 15 years. They cut that out. They yeah. cut all that silliness out because you can't. Nobody's going to walk in off the street and compete with a guy like you or you. Even think he's been doing it for or myself. I mean, people have been doing it for 10, 15 years. I mean, you know,
guys dressed like a spaceman.
Yeah, some guys in a gorilla costume. He wants to do 5 minutes. Yeah. Guy's over there eating a banana with his foot. He wants to do a drop and do a guest set. You know,
my first time at Last Comic standing in line, there was a guy dressed up like a caveman. Like half caveman, half pimp. And he had jokes too. Yeah. I've been doing this for 10 years. Okay. Where at?
Yeah.
I have a little shop somewhere.
There's a comedy cavern.
So you started you were a magician when you were 15?
Yeah, man. Yeah. No, man. You know what's funny? I still do it. I still dabble in it.
What got you into that?
Well, you know, man, it's funny. My brother Bobby played the drums. My brother Joey played guitar. My mom would drop them off for music lessons on a Monday night. And I would go, you know, I was hanging out with my brothers. And down the street was like a magic shop. And I got like a magic kit when I was about 9 years old. And I started doing it. And I started like, you know, and it was a good little magic kit. It was kind of cool, well made. And I started messing around with the tricks. And then I had a job delivering circulars. You know, I've had jobs my whole life. I was a kid. I could never remember a time when I didn't have like a freaking day job. I had 6 brothers. My mom was charging me rent when I was like 15, 16. I'd give her $40 a month. I don't mind it because, you know, I was helping out. But, you know, my mom's doing, you know, your laundry and your work and who cares? But I would work so I can buy money and she would drop them off at the music lessons. We had an hour to kill. We'd go down to the magic shop. And I would get one trick, and I would buy one joke book. That was my thing. These old Robert Orban joke books, you know. And I would come home, and I would, like, you know, work on the magic trick, and I would read the joke books. I started circle jokes. Oh, that's funny. I had a little joke file. And then when I was 18, man, I kind of just, like, hung up the wand. I retired the rabbit. I let the doves go. You know, I said, I just want to find a room and be funny, you know.
And I took my handkerchief out of my coat.
Yeah. I got rid of
the rabbit.
I released the doves out of my sleeve. I said, this is it.
Got rid of my assistant.
Yeah. I got rid of my assistant. I let my assistant go. I fired my assistant. But yeah, I was doing.
Got rid of you the
know,
wand.
But, yeah, but when I was like, when I was 15, I was doing like 5-6 gigs a month. I was doing like, you know, you're doing like, you know, you do like the, they had the Boy Scout Jamboree. You do a stage show. You're doing kids' birthday parties.
Quinceañeras.
Yeah. I was doing exactly. I was doing a bunch of different shows. I would do private magic shows for adult parties and stuff. And it was awesome. It was, I was gigging. You know, when you were like, when you're 15 and you got like 5 or 6 gigs a month and you're making like $150 for the thing. And my old man wasn't like a stage dad. You know what I mean? My old man was a detective.
He was a cop, right?
Yeah, he was a cop, a hardcore old school detective. Like, you know, Lieutenant Columbo. I mean, I'm not kidding you. He'd drive me to the gigs in his beat up pickup truck. I'm sitting there in my oversized tuxedo. I had my doves in his, cause it was like a hand me down freaking thing. I mismatched. I got my Dugs in a shoebox with the holes punched in the top. Like, and I was like, you know, just pitching shit all over the place. Don't you? And I was like, we're driving. And my old man's going, you practice, right? You practice. It's like, he always does this thing where he coughs. All right, you're not going to give him short shrift, are you? What's short shrift? Yeah, it's, well, you're giving him less than 100%. So, and I would, you know, and I was with this, like, this group where we would do like these, you know, I would do a lot of shows. I mean, for like, you know, old age homes and children's hospital and stuff. It's the only way you're good. And I would do these shows at children's hospital. And then a lot of these nurses, these black nurses would hire me to do their churches in West Philadelphia, some of the worst neighborhoods, but they're like good church going folks. So you drive in there and my old man's got his 9mm on his hip, you know, just making sure just in case anybody tries to rob the magician. Abracadabra. Now you see it. Now you don't. Boom! You know,
I'm trying to jack the magician, bro. No funny tricks.
No funny. I'm trying. But it was. I mean, you know, that's how I kind of like, you know, like started in show business, and I did like high school talent competitions. And finally, I was like, you know, man, enough with these pictures. Enough with standing in front of my mom and dad is a giant like mirror in their house. I used to stand in front of and practice for hours. I was like, you know what? Enough of this. I'm just writing some damn jokes. I want to make people laugh, and that's really, you know, kind of how I get started. It's all I pretty much done my whole adult life was do it. It took me a long time to get good at it, though. You know, I mean, you know, it took me about 9 years to get really funny, you know, working on it and stuff. But yeah, did it for a couple of years in Philly, and then when I came to LA, wound up you know, working the doorman and doing that, came up through that system, wound up touring with Sam Kinison, toured with him for 5 years. He died in 92. He's almost been dead 23 years now. That's how long ago that is. I mean, you know, God rest his soul. But that was really kind of my intro into, like, you know, and I was just, the great thing about working with him was he really kind of set the bar pretty high for stand up. You know, you gotta have your own voice, you gotta have your own thing, and you go work on that. You know, if you're able to make your living doing this for like 25 years, I think you're already a success.
Yeah.
I mean, knowing how tough this business is and everything, and it is, it's a really tough business. I mean, you know, some people get lucky, get the break. Some guys fall off the bus when they arrive to LA and they wind up with a sitcom. Other people work for 25 years, they get their break. You know, it's just your path is your path. So you do it because you love to do it. I mean, some people go, I want to do it. A lot of people I know do it because they think they're going to become famous. I go, boy, yeah, another thing coming. I mean, you have a better chance to become a famous magician. You do
get the doves. You
know, get your doves out. Go to the magic shop and work on an act. You know, but it's you've done it. You know, like the, you know, when it's going good, it's going good. And when it's bad, it's bad. I mean, the summer before I did Last Comic Standing, I had a, you know, it was just a, I had a rough summer, you know, and summertime's rough around here, you know, nobody wants to sit inside of the comedy club, and that's what kind of really prompted me to do that and to kind of get back into it and do Last Comic Standing, and David Tell called, and I got on David Tell's Comedy Underground and kind of had a little bit of a resurgence, and I'm just trying to, you know, and I took that whole month to work on a new hour and kind of, we're getting ready to tape it. Eventually we'll have an hour on Netflix and stuff, you know. All you got to do is ask me one question.
So
I asked the guy two questions on my hour long podcast.
You've done
hell yeah,
no. You've done all the hell gigs probably, right? All the tour, like the strip.
I did all the hell gigs twice. I did all the hell gigs twice or three times. I remember sleeping in my car. I had literally driven, like, I couldn't, I mean, you know, you're slapping yourself in the face, you're down the window. I remember I pulled into this rest area. It was about 54 miles from Missoula, Montana, which is where I was headed. It was snowing. I remember I pulled in, I had this, like, you know, I had this car, and I remember it was snowing, and I cracked my window, but thank God my heater was working in my car, and I looked out, and it looked like there was this old train coming by, and the snow was falling, and it reminded me, like, you ever set those trains up underneath your Christmas tree? It reminded me of that thing. That was the last thing I remember before I dozed off, and I woke up, and I kind of drove in, and then I did Saco, Montana, which was 60 miles from Helena. It's like 60 miles from the Canadian border. Like, you know, I could smell, like, there was a herd of cattle. I mean, you could smell them from your room. It was horrible, horrible gig. I had more books at home on my bookshelf than they had in the town library. You know, the Wooders, you know, I think Robbie Knievel was coming in there to jump the barn. I mean, you know, there was the big event for the year. I mean, I've done, you know, I mean, just like the most amazing, you know, you've done all these gigs. I mean, if they speak English, I've worked there, you know, and sometimes if they didn't speak English, I worked there, you know, yeah, I did them all. I did the creative runs all through the Southeast. I did the triple runs all through the Northwest. You know, I've done, you know, the gigs. Yeah, I pretty much.
So you've been to, all over Washington, Richland,
yeah, Washington, Oregon. Kelso, Washington, over there through, yeah, exactly. I've done
what that club we did in Richland.
Jokers.
That comedy club has a like a Chuck E. Cheese event with bowling and pizza place.
Yeah, yeah.
Then they connected to a little poker house. Then you go to the poker house. Is that where the comedy club is?
Yeah, they have a gig like that in Peoria. There's a racetrack. Yeah, the jukebox is a racetrack, and these guys are flying around the track. You see the dust shooting up. There's a racetrack. There's a comedy club. I think there's a strip club over here.
Yeah,
and I'm going, this is what they do on the weekends here. They go race and watch comedy and, you know, go to a strip club. I mean, there's a lot of, I've done a lot of those gigs. I just, now it's like, you know, instead of working so hard, I try to work a little smarter. And you just pick the markets that you go, I can build a following in this market. I could do, you get 26 markets that you could do twice a year, every 8 months, and you work on developing a following in those markets so you don't got to do, you know, Bubba's belt buckle in Philadelphia, Mississippi. You know, try to.
So you were an original Outlaws of Comedy.
Yeah, I was. It was me as a kid guy named Mitch Walters. I mean, these guys were all much older than I was. I mean, I was like a little, hey guys, wait.
How old were you, like 25?
Yeah, 25, 26. And, you know, Carl LeBeau.
That blew your mind to be like, to go on the road as big.
Yeah, yeah. And comic. I was doing some other stuff. You know, sometimes you had to make sure the bags got to the rooms. Hey, make sure, you know, you had to do some stuff. But, you know, these guys had all been doing it. I was just I was happy to be there. Let's put it that way. And I didn't mind doing any of that stuff. And I used to go, you know, we'd pull in the bus. We'd dump to make sure everybody got their bags to the rooms. And then, Sam would go, hey, I'm going to do radio. And everybody would go, yeah, go do radio. And I go, I'll go do radio with you. And I used to travel. They'd send us a limo. We'd go do radio. And I watched Sam do radio. I would learn how to do radio watching him do it. You know, some people, I don't want to do radio. I go, I don't care, man. Promote yourself. Promote your website. People always go, I want to do radio. I go, no, you got to do radio, man. It's part of the gig. You know, some people hate it. For guys like me, because I'm not, you're not Bill Burr, or you're not at that level. And if you can do good radio, you can sell tickets.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's what that's what I learned. I mean, even Kinison would do radio. If he was sold out, he didn't do radio. No need to do radio. But if he wasn't, he was short. He had to go do radio to sell the tickets, and he would do it. And he would go and just take it over and just, and do great radio. And if you do that, I could see it affects my show. If you get up in the morning, you go and do like 5-6 radio stations and just knock it out of the park, you'll sell tickets. You know, and so, yeah, but that's where I learned how to do it. I learned a lot of how to do things, and I also learned what not to do. Like, if I'm faced with a very crucial show business decision now, I go, what would Sam Kinison do? And then I do the opposite. because he was a legendary dude, man. And there were times where, you know, it was great working with him, and there was other times where it was you just prayed to God. You go, man, I hope I get through all this. You know, there was a lot of, you know, because they were mixing a truckload of business, a truckload of personalities, and a truckload of, you know, booze and extracurricular activities. You know, a little Bolivian marching powder. You know, what I mean?
We're hanging out. What time we came up to you? I was there with a girl and with some other guy named Tony Sanchez and Gabriel Iglesias. And we stopped you at the comedy store. You were on your way out.
Yeah.
And you talked to us about comedy for about an hour and a half.
Really?
I thought that was really nice.
Yeah, man. Because
you give a lot of advice.
No, but because I always, like, you know, I mean, God, man, a ton of guys helped me out and gave me advice. And I think as an artist, you know, as a stand-up artist, and you want to be a good ambassador to stand-up comedy, and you want to help a lot of young dudes. And I love doing that. I mean, because I was always a student of the craft and a student of the game. And people, you know, Paul Mooney and Gary Shandling and sometimes Louis Anderson. And Dice, and you talk to these guys, and they would impart some wisdom on you. You go, oh, that makes a lot of sense. Well, that's it, you know. And Freddie Asparagus. I don't know if you know Freddie Asparagus. You remember Freddie Asparagus? You know, remember?
Yeah, I remember him. Willie Barcena told me about it. He was a chubby guy with long hair.
He also was a brilliant improvisation guy. He also was a good.
I'm gonna do something.
I know the something.
Yeah, he met another guy, right? Quentin.
Yeah, Quentin. Yeah, yeah.
He's the one introduced me to Latino Night.
Yeah, yeah. Quentin was a repo man.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm buddies with him on Facebook. He was a good, solid dude. But I'm going to do the same thing, you know, but he would do these
characters. He's a good actor, huh?
Yeah, a great actor. Been in a ton of movies. But he told me, he gave me a piece of advice. It took me like 2 or 3 years to figure out. He said, you know, stand-up comedy is one of those art forms that you have to disrespect before you can respect it. I was like, what does that mean? And I didn't want to sound like an idiot, but I think what he was trying to say, or at least what I got out of it was that, you know, the minute you stop trying to figure out what makes the audience laugh and you go up there and you have a good time and you don't care about, you know, once you allow yourself and give yourself permission to suck, you will also give yourself permission to be great and, you know, and allow yourself to really find who you authentically are on stage. And I think that's, so I always loved, that's funny that you remember that. And I do remember that night hanging with you guys because I always loved hanging out with guys and talking about, because when we go up Crest Hill, I mean, that was the thing, like Crest Hill was the house behind the Comedy Store. It was like the frat house, you know, and guys, Sam would come up there and these guys would come up and we would talk about comedy for hours and figure it out and try to figure it out. It was like a big, you know, trying to take it apart and put it back together again, you know? And so, I always feel that way, you know, I mean, you know, more so now, you know, you concentrate on, you know, I mean, the guys that more so now, I try to help myself. You know, you try to go, okay. But, you know, if somebody's a friend and calls for advice, you always go, yeah, well, I would do it this way, or this is the way I would do it. But, yeah, you try to, you know, help out.
Yeah, man.
I remember that. That's right. We sat there and talked comedy. Because yeah. I would love talking about it. I was trying to figure it out and try to figure out, you know, what you're wearing on stage and how am I going to try to say what I'm trying to say before. Because it's all, you know, people don't realize, you know, people just go, oh, you just go up there and say funny shit. No. You're good. I mean, you know, so, like, yeah, like you two people are walking down the street and they're walking this way and, you know, they're just walking. They don't even say a word. There's so much nonverbal communication that happens between these two people until they actually get to, you know, oh, what's this guy doing? People are having all these conversations inside their head as they're passing this person, and they pass each other, and they don't say a word, but they've already made so much nonverbal communication. Well, that's what happens when you go from the side of the stage to the microphone. I mean, half those people have already made up their mind about you. So the way you walk to the microphone, the way you what you wear, the way you grab it. I mean, all that says so much about you before you even said anything. And then your jokes, your opening jokes, got to set up you for the rest of your show. I mean, It's a layered kind of thing. There's so many variables thrown into that equation. I mean, if you want to do it at a high level, I mean, there was always work to do. It's like your golf game. There's always work to do, man. You're never going to do it as good as you want. I mean, you'll have moments where you go, man, that was amazing, you know, where you're on the mound and you're just striping it down the middle and nobody can anything you're throwing, you know, that it's kind of like, you know, there's always work to do.
So you're a good friend with Freddie Soto?
Yeah, I knew Freddie. He used to call me Two Shoes. I love Freddie. He goes, Jimmy, Two Shoes. And I loved him, man, because Freddie was one of those guys you walk in and he would give you a big bear hug. And I loved hanging out with him and his wife, Corey, I knew. And, you know, and I just, man, that broke my heart. I loved that guy. He was really just I always had a smile on his face.
Always.
You know, always just a great, fun guy to hang out with, man. And, you know, there was... You know, you get to meet folks here, man, sometimes. Like, you know, when I was in Florida, because I moved to Florida after Sam died, I wanted to get away from it all, and I met Mitch, and Mitch started at this club. And, you know, Mitch was really kind of a shy, like, delicate guy.
Mitch Hedberg?
Yeah, yeah. And you go, you know, I've run into Mitch, but I was always good to Mitch. Like you said, you know, you always help guys out, and I just felt, you know, as Mitch was like, he was just a frail guy. Like, you know, sometimes when you get so big and everybody wants a piece and you're supposed to do this and you got to do this and I just want to make people laugh. And it kind of, you get a little distracted a little bit sometimes. And I think, you know, I mean, God rest his soul. I don't, you know, but I mean, another guy died too soon, you know, and Sam, I mean, I lost Sam too. I mean, he was a lunatic, but he was starting to get his act together and he was starting to clean up and he was getting married and he was getting ready to have a baby. I mean, in a car accident, his wife lost the baby, but you know, it's like, I was getting ready to, Chris Farley thing, John Belushi. I don't know what the deal is with comedians, but, you know, these guys are always Robin Williams. I mean, I was just, yesterday was the year anniversary of his death. I don't know what the deal is with comedians. You know,
do you know him personally?
Yeah. I mean, Dude, I got a great picture. I got a great picture. It's me, Robin Williams, and Sam Kinison on stage, and they were doing.
Send it to Will. Put it on a podcast.
Oh, dude, I'll show it to you right afterwards. Yeah, yeah. It's amazing. But this is one of my favorite pictures. But I used to work the door with Noodles Levinstein and Robin.
What shirts did you wear? White comedy store or black comedy store?
No, dude, I had a tuxedo on, bro.
I had
a tuxedo.
I have a magic cape.
No, dude, I had it left over for my magic date. because on a Saturday night in that comedy club, and I'm talking about the height of the comedy explosion in Los Angeles.
89?
Yeah, they were doing three shows a night in there.
Wow.
Three shows a night and selling out all 500 seats. And me and Noodles were broke doormen. We had $5 between us, and I would wait till the day, and he would come in and hand me the $5, and I would go, like, he goes, hey, that's from the last table you sat. And he'd throw it in my hand right in front of the people I'm getting ready to seat. And I would go sit those, and I'd walk back in and go, here's from the table you just sat. And we passed that $5 back and forth, and at the end of the night, we put our money. We made tip money. We made some, I mean, guys would give you a $100 tip to get a booth. That's how we ate, man. I mean, that was like, you know, on a weekend, you can make some money sit in that room, and That was like my college, man. The comedy store was like my college for sure. You know,
that's funny. The little hustle, huh? Sit me by the table, man. Don't sit me next to my lady over there.
you'd throw that $5 and just let the people know they had the tip, and at the end of the night you'd throw your tip money in. You're like, we're splitting $150 a piece.
Hell yeah.
Were you at the comedy store there on that Monday night when there was the shooting?
Wasn't there for that. Wasn't there for that. I mean, so funny, Monday night.
It
got crazy, dude. I remember I drove Sam Kinison off stage on a motorcycle. Yeah. I didn't realize he was scared to death of motorcycles, but it was like late night. It was like, you know, it was a Monday night. It was like 1:45. They had a little Thai bartenders running around going, he got off now. I'm going, he's doing comedy, man. And I'm sitting backstage on my motorcycle. And the guy said, you gonna ride that out there? I go, no. He goes, well, it's never been done before. And I go, all right, that settles that. And I went out there and he jumped on the back and we raced down that little back hallway out into Sunset Boulevard, made a U-turn on La Cienega. And he had a death grip on me. I could barely like breathe. He goes, you're a crazy motherfucker. And because I think he just thought I was going to drive him off stage, give him a ride. But that kind of cemented it. And then I dropped him off. I didn't see him for 2 weeks. And I walked in the comedy store and I heard, Jimmy Schubert, you crazy motherfucker, get over here. And it was Kinison. And he was with Lorraine Newman and Randy Quaid. And he comes up, he goes, come here. And he puts his arm around me. And I didn't realize how cool it was until he thought how cool it was. And he told the story to Lorraine Newman and Randy Quaid. And it was like, man, this is freaking awesome. And then it was just, you know, but yeah, moments like that, like stories like that. And just, you know, watching guys, like, you know, watching Richard Pryor come in and build, like, you know, he would come in and he hadn't really done stand up in a while. He would start and could talk to the audience for like 5 to 7 minutes. You know, and then like 3 months later, the guy's building it into, you see him building it into a new set. And it's just, it was amazing to watch his process. You know, you'd watch Robin Williams would come in. Robin Williams and Sam Kinison would improvise all the time. You watch that. You got to watch, you know, playing the main room, you know, Arsenio Hall. I mean, all these guys, Jim Carrey, I got to be friendly with these guys who come around, you know. I just saw Damon Wayans at the Flappers Comedy Club in Burbank, and I was on stage, and he popped in to do a guest set and came up to me and gave me a big hug. He got to watch my set. He got, you know, so you form friendship with these guys and all these guys. Watching guys like Damon Wayans, I mean, who's better than that guy? I mean, that guy, I don't think since Richard Pryor, does anybody have a sense of honesty on stage like that cat, you know? I mean, yeah.
He was the first guy I saw when I got the balls to finally sit. Stop saying I want to be a comedian and go up on stage.
Who?
He was Damon Wayans.
Yeah,
his sister had just finished going up on stage.
Kim.
Yeah, then he followed her, and then he went up, and everybody stood up clapping, and then he put down his jacket, and then he goes, "Man, 10 years ago, just a regular black guy taking off his jacket."
Yeah,
and then he went up there, and he was talking about his son getting caught masturbating.
Yeah.
Damon Wayans Jr.
Yeah, yeah.
And he talked about his wife catching him cheating, and then it got quiet, and there were no more laughs. And then it got more serious and serious. Then there was a little bit of laughs. Then it got really, like, awkward. Yeah, man. Yeah. I never seen a comedian do that. I always thought it was laughs.
Yeah.
I never see a breakdown and get the audience back.
Yeah.
And I said, if comedy is like that, I could do it.
Yeah. Well, he, you know, and everybody has that guy. You know, I think for Joe Rogan, he said it was Sam Kinison was the guy he saw that said, hey, oh, if it's comedy's like that, I can do that. You know, I talk. But it's funny. He would go up and has, I call them jazz sets. He would have these jazz sets like that in the original room, and he would have a glass of orange juice, and the people would get like weird, and he would go, look, when I'm done my orange juice, I'm going to get the hell out of here. And he would sit, and he just had a little bit of orange juice, and he was really kind of savoring that last little bit of orange juice. And I would run to the back bar, get a brand new glass of orange juice, and walk up and go, oh, by the way, man, here's another glass of orange juice. Oh, look at that. I got a whole new glass of orange juice. He would get to torture the audience a little more. But, I mean, I loved, for me, man, that was like as close as like that camaraderie and you know, watching guys do it. Because I got to tell you, man, it really is, it's really one of the toughest art forms to do, because you're by yourself, and you know, and anybody who's done it for a long time knows. I mean, if you've been doing it for 20 years, you know, got mad respect for anybody who's been able to do it and make their living and pay their bills doing it. It's a tough way to make a living for sure.
Hell yeah.
Remember at the comedy store, I was into it like 6-7 minutes, you know, and then the star went on, the blue light, and I wasn't having a good set, but I was just doing whatever, right? And then they said, bring up Damien Wayans. Somebody yelled, all right, people, the next guy, man, he's going to really make you guys laugh. He's real funny, Damien Wayans. And he stopped me by my shoulder. He goes, man, fuck this crowd. You're fucking funny.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, oh, man, I felt good after that.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's funny.
I was like, oh,
okay. Are you still with her boy, Jay Schachter? You still represented by Jay Schachter?
No, man, he left to Abrams.
I know.
And didn't even call us.
Yeah. You know what Jay Schachter did? Yeah, let me tell you something. I love Jay Schachter. I mean, that dude was like, he's one of those agents. Like, you got an agent like Jay Schachter. Jay Schachter's one of those guys. Oh. I go, when he was handling me, man, he was sending me off on the right stuff, and boom. So,
yeah, we got right here our Kings of Queens, Entourage.
Yeah, I mean, dude, Jay, I mean, that's the thing. You know, you do stand up. I'm lucky enough that I did 15 episodes of King of Queens. I've done 4 episodes of Entourage, did 2 episodes of ER, I did some Reno 911. I mean, I've had a
career. You're an Italian job?
Italian job. I had, you know, Mr. one hour. Mrs. Smith. 1 hour photo with Robin Williams. You know, I get to work with, you know, these legendary guys. I had a scene.
All because of Jay Schachter.
Yeah. Well, Jay Schachter was one of those guys, but, you know, shoot, I've had managers. I've been lucky that, like, you know, I wish I had this guy named Jeff Gitlin. This guy picked me up. I was flying in from a gig. Picked me up at an airport. He goes, I'm picking you up at the airport. I'm driving you to the audition. Drove me right to the audition. And it was Mr. and Mrs. Smith. And No, it was for 1 hour photo. And I wound up getting a gig. I'm like, I would kill. I mean, he got out of the business, but I would kill to have that manager, like a manager like that. That guy was like great. I got a good manager now though, but I'm just saying, like that kind of stuff, you know, agents like Jay Schachter who believe in you, who know exactly what you are and send you out for jobs that are in your wheelhouse. I mean, I got nothing but mad respect for a guy like Jay. I've had a couple agents. I mean, they're not. They're very few and far between. I think the goal is you got to put together that team. This agent gets it. The manager gets it. I got a PA agent that gets it. We're all on the same page. All big happy family. Awesome. Let's all move forward. Now you can do shit in this business. You know, rather than
Jay Schachter kept. If everybody listening, man, he had like a lot of clients. You know what? He never dropped us. He never dropped me.
No, no, but he
yeah, Jay London, me.
Yeah, he, it looked like a cast.
Troy Medina.
Yeah, it was like a cast of Batman's villains.
It was a real artist.
It was like a cast of Batman's villains. Jay Schachter represented us. He's over there at Abrams now. Hope he's having a good time.
Come on, Jay. We were the real art fan.
What are we, chopped liver over here? Abrams, sorry, it's not like you're over at CAA. How about that? You see that? Like the CAA, and they had like 11 people leave CAA and go over to UTA. I saw like 7 agents left. They went from CAA over to UTA. The next day, 3 more agents left over to UTA. And then the head of the department leaves over to UTA with Melissa McCarthy going, well, I ain't seen nothing like this in show business. This is like a coup. This is like a coup.
That really happened?
Yeah, it really happened. Not too long ago either. It was a big deal.
Mad
wow.
Yeah. And then freaking my personal appearance agent, I'm playing golf with him, going, hey, man. And says, boy, they must have a real opening over there at CAA. Next thing you know, he leaves to go over to CAA.
Somebody call my agent. Tell him to go over there. Somebody call Tim.
Hey, no, no. You don't want to be at CAA. You get lost in the shuffle over there.
Yeah.
You know, they handle a lot of those e-celebrities, internet celebrities. Well, the guy's got 6 million Vine followers. How does that translate?
To shows.
Yeah, how does that translate? Are you going to do that? What, is this guy going to show Vine videos of the comedy? You know, you're going to compete against that? Yeah, she's got 1 million people following her on Twitter. It's a big deal. Can you do 45 minutes at a comedy club? Can you leave an audience, you know, exhausted from laughing for an hour of comedy? I mean, I, you know what the thing is? It's funny because I'm glad you brought this up. No, but you compete, like, this is an art form that I've been, like, you know, how much I love to do it and how much it means to me. And then you got to go compete with a guy who, you know, lights his balls on fire. Really? Guy plays for the LA Lakers and he's hosting shows down the Improv. Met a world pinnacle. And the Lakers ain't called me in to do free throws. I mean, I'm just doing it, you know. I mean,
it's free throw Jimmy.
Yeah. But I'm saying, you know, how about a little, because it's kind of insulting. It's like getting slapped in the face. I go, look, if I take like 3 or 4 weeks off from doing stand-up, I can tell I'm a little rusty. My timing's just a little bit off. This guy's never done it, and he's hosting shows. You know, I'm going, you're taking work out of a comic's pocket. It's like somebody's pocket.
I know, man. You're like, wait a minute. This guy's at the Young Comedian Show in Toronto, Montreal.
Yeah.
And they send these guys over there. They got big agents, man. I know that one guy had 1 million followers, and now he wants to dabble in stand-up comedy. You don't dabble in it, man.
No,
dabble.
You live it, breathe it, eat it, and sleep it. You bleed it. It's you know.
So it breaks your heart.
Well, it's like, you know, it makes you sound like, you know, hey, I'm Soggy, the Dunk Tank Clown. No, I'm not. It's, you know, I'm a professional artist here, and you know, and when I watch guys do it at a high level, you know, Attell and Stanhope and Burr, and, you know, yourself, myself included in that group, and guys have been doing it for a long time, and, you know, Tripoli and all those
Joey
guys.
Coco.
Joey Coco.
That's right, cocksucker.
No, but I mean, you know, those guys have all been doing it. I mean, I love watching dudes that do it at a high level like that, and you know, I'm a fan of it as much as I love to do it. I'm a fan of it, you know.
Who did you love growing up?
Dude, man, I love, it's so funny. My parents had these Jimmy Durante albums I used to listen to when I was a kid. And then Carlin and Pryor, some Bob Newhart, like they had the you know, some albums that, you know, but, yeah, it was really Carlin and Pryor at the time. And then when you get into stand up, you discovered, I went back and listened to some Lenny Bruce stuff, but, you know, I like Gleason. And when I was a kid, man, I loved Charlie Chaplin. I mean, I love that he was able to do it in silent movies, that he could make people laugh and not say a word. I thought was brilliant. And I always loved Charlie Chaplin. To me, it was like I used to run home and watch Charlie Chaplin. And I remember when I was like 7 or 8, I remember crying on my way back from church because my mom wouldn't let me dye my hair black and grow a little toothbrush mustache.
I want to be Hitler.
Yeah, talk about a guy who ruined a toothbrush mustache for everybody.
And Donald Trump ruined bad haircut for everybody.
Oh man, look, you can say, I love that he's in there because he's
the truth.
The truth. I mean,
damn, man, he laid it down on that.
And you can't. You know what the thing is? If you go and actually do the research, the guy, look, guys amassed a $10 billion fortune. He's not a dumb guy, and he don't need to do this. I mean, dude, the guy's got $10 billion in his bank account. Like, he lives private jets, private choppers. He got a badass comb over. I don't see this guy don't need any of this aggravation. I just think the guy is legitimate in his want to make the country great again. I mean,
shaking up the game
and keeping it real, at least, you know, because all these other guys are for sale. They're all for sale, bought and sold. I mean, that's why democracy's tough, because by the time you get done sifting through the carefully crafted communications, the 30-second ads and the secret handshakes and the money's exchanged and back rooms, and you realize that nobody of any substance is going to make it through the mire because they've already wrapped their lips around the cock of corporate, greed, and they got to answer to all these people. Trump, on the other hand, is not for sale. You can't buy him. So just that he's in the race and keeping it real. And I don't know whether he really wants to be president or what the game he's playing here. I don't know what his motives are, but say what you want about, I mean, you look at all these candidates. I mean, there's 16, 17 choices on the one side, and you got two choices on the other side, and one of them's a fucking arch criminal. I mean, Hillary Clinton's a fucking arch criminal. I mean, I'm sorry. You know, they're seizing her fucking server as we speak. You know what I mean? I mean, I don't.
FBI took the Thunberg.
Yeah, right? But I'm not really a Republican or a Democrat. I'm really kind of a libertarian, and I'm socially liberal on some issues. I don't care about gay marriage or any of that stuff. I don't care. All that stuff is bullshit. Let people do what they want to do. God doesn't make junk. If you're gay, you were born that way. And you're a person, and you should be able to do everything everybody else is able to do, and be kind of inclusive. And look, we're all trying to get through this. You know what I mean? We're all trapped in this giant human ecosphere. We should all just get along. But you got, you know, Black Lives Matter. Nothing else does, but they do. And, I get it. Hey, listen, I get pulled over a lot. You know, I comply. I put my hands on the wheel. I go, yes, sir. No, sir. You want to stick your finger in my ass and check for fucking paraphernalia? Help yourself. All right. I'm not, I get it.
I got a bag to hide.
Yeah. Hey, if you want to find it up in my fucking raisin hole, you're going to earn it. You know what I mean? but I'm just saying, I mean, you know, the thing is like, you know, we can't we all just like, and we're supposed to be an evolved species. It seems like we're getting dumber. It seems like we're getting dumber. It seems like people are, you know, like, we're just supposed to be, you know, can't we just
get along.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's just, to me, it's amazing that you know, we're becoming more sensitive, and it seems like we're becoming dumber. It's because everybody's got their cell phones, which is this portal into this vacuous, you're just sucked into this thing. You're not even paying attention. I just think the thing that made the human race great was our ability to make eye contact and discuss ideas and concepts in an intelligent way. You can't even have a decent conversation about race relations in this country, you know, or any people get like, you'd say, I mean, if you don't believe me, go post something political on Facebook and watch the fun begin. Because like, people monitor the fact, going, get outside, get off the goddamn fucking computer, go out and live your life, go out and, you know, you want to change the world, go out and change the world, go make a sandwich for a guy standing on the corner and say, hey, I need food, go make, change it, do little things, you know, I mean, change your world. You know, you sit there and you know the people are on their laptop, they're in the same clothes, on Sunday they left work on Friday night, they got their fingers are orange from eating Doritos. They got three empty cans of Red Bull. They're living in their parents' basement rent free, surfing their neighbor's wireless internet, trolling your fucking Twitter account, starting shit. I'm going, who the fuck are you to judge me, you cocksucker? You cocksucker, Joey Coco. But I mean, yeah, I mean, fuck. I mean, I don't know. It just seems to me, I mean, you know, you got to look at a guy like Jon Stewart, who's on a comedy network. He retired. But I mean, Jon Stewart was talking more truth and giving you more news than you can get on an actual goddamn evening news program. I mean, you know, it's gotten topsy turvy. You know, comedians are, you know, it's, when do you, when in the world does that happen? You know, I mean, comedians are talking more truth than the corporate media outlets like NBC News or ABC News, and they all got an agenda. Fox News has an agenda. Hell yeah. ABC has an agenda. CBS has an agenda. Hey, could you just give me the fucking news and let me go research it and make up my own goddamn mind about it? Or do you got to twist it and word it? And you know, it's crazy.
What do you think, Rodrigo?
It's fucking dropping knowledge over here, dog. He's fucking right. And as far as like fucking Donald Trump, that motherfucker's just ruffling feathers. He's not going to be the fucking president, but he's making those motherfuckers uneasy in their suits.
Well, he should make them uneasy, because you know what? The American dream here has been under assault for the last 30 years. And I'll tell you something right now. There's been Republicans in charge and Democrats in charge and Republicans in charge and Democrats in charge. And they've had opportunities to change the system and make the system better for people like us. They no longer represent us. They represent corporate interests. Hey, welcome to the FedEx, United States of Bank of America. They should change it, because it's all corporate interest. It's big pharmacology, you look at all these shootings. We don't have a gun control problem in this country, because I grew up with guns. I got a gun in my house. You kick in my door, I'm gonna empty the clip into you. But
tell him, Jimmy Schubert.
I left my gun there at my house, and I put it on my patio, and it didn't shoot anybody. I was left it there. I left there for a couple of days, and no one got shot. But I'm saying, if you look at it, all these school shootings. I mean, these kids are all on this, they're all on Zoloft or Prozac when they're 12 and 13 because they're a little, they're just being fucking kids, really. But, before their brains are fully formed, people are throwing pills down their throat, and it's psychotropic. It's behavior altering medication, and they turn them into zombies, and that's why these people snap. They're bipolar. They're schizophrenic or whatever the fucking deal is. I mean, let their brains form and then let them grow up to be adults. Maybe they'll work through the shit. You gotta fucking put them on those goddamn medication. I mean, let them be fucking human beings first and figure it the fuck out. But
let them fall.
Yeah, but yep. Let them fall. Let them fall off the bike. Let them fail. I mean, fucking Michael Jordan said something. He goes, the reason I'm so good is because I failed so much. You got to fail because you got to want to get better. But I'm saying, you can't. But what I'm saying is that the American dream has been understood. I just think they're all full of shit. I think the Republicans are full of shit. I think the Democrats are full of shit. And the reason I like a guy like Trump, because he's not full of shit. Maybe he is, and maybe he has his own little agenda. I don't know. But at least he's keeping it honest. And the fact of the matter is that I'm just tired. Because we're talking about Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton. I mean, fuck, that ain't a democracy. That's two of the same families running our fucking goddamn country for the last 30 fucking years with a break with Obama in the fucking middle. I mean, come on. Can we get, are there no other people that are qualified to run the country besides the Bushes and the fucking Clintons? I mean, Hillary's in big fucking shit now. She's out. Bernie Sanders, at least, finally. But I mean, to me, that just reeks of, it's just, these people want to put the same people in so you have the same result and everything goes the same way. It's always gone. So for that reason, I love Trump because he's keeping it fucking real.
He had me laughing, man.
Yeah, that shit is hilarious.
Well, I watched, that's the first debate I actually watched completely ever.
And Friday night,
then I saw it again. And then when he said that, when a guy asked him, but you buy politicians. And he said, yeah, I give money to everybody in here.
Yeah. Well,
and when I ask for something, they get it. I get it.
Truth. And a couple of them say, you didn't give money to me. He goes, well, we'll fix that after the debate. I'll write you a check.
No, Ted Cruz said that banging ass. No, the other guy from Miami, Rubio, he said, you can send some money over here.
Yeah. That's what a guy like Trump does. I mean, but that's the way politics works. I mean, that's what the thing is that, you give these guys money, now they owe you favors. And that's why, they're the last thing they give them damn about is guys like us out here struggling and busting your ass. I mean, it seems like you get punished in this country for starting your own business and being your own guy and being your own thing. It's like, yeah, well, now you owe me this much money in tax money. And there's your franchise tax board. I go, what are you talking? I'm not selling shoes. I'm a freaking comedian. I make most of my income on the road. I go, oh, fuck, I get you. Every time I stick my hand in my pocket, I'm shaking hands with some mid-level government functionary who wants to take some more of my money so he can dole it out to some meth head who's living in a Motel 6 with six kids from six different guys because somehow her lack of personal responsibility is now my thing. Hey, I'm taking care of my own people over here. You know what I mean? Give me a break.
Philly's finest, everybody.
Everybody, man. You do somebody a favor, they want something back. Like, you ever get a ride from Chewy? Chewy from the comedy store?
Hey, Chewy! What's going on? Hey, Chewy! What's going on? Hey, Chewy! What's going on?
Remember that? Were you there?
I've been there. I used to see him at the House of Blues all the time.
Remember at the House of Blues? I don't know. I only saw him two times, but that was one of the best times I ever saw him. And it felt good. It was probably one of the best vibes ever because I saw a lot of comics there. Joe Rogan was there.
Yeah.
And that was the day that
people used to go out and support
Rick James started playing the piano.
Oh, yeah.
On Chewy's birthday.
Oh, no kidding, man. Yeah, I've seen him there a couple times. He had amazing musicians. Like, he had that Hammond B3. The guy playing the Hammond B3 behind him. That's like, Hey, Chewy, what's going on? Hey, Chewy, hey, can I get a bag? Chewy, what's going on? No, that was
powder.
Yeah, that was, that's...
When you started there at the comedy store, was that guy already there, like, performing Robert William Abadiah?
Yeah, believe it or not.
What was his story?
I don't know his story, bro. I mean, I was always nice to that guy.
Me too.
Because
I would give him a little roach.
Yeah, but dude, you just be nice to people. I would watch guys like Don Barris torture people like that. Yeah.
They used to push the chairs in front of him so he could not watch.
And I would just go, you know what, man? Let's leave the guy alone. It's obviously the guy's got problems. Why don't you just try to be a human being? Quit being a bully. I used to see guys down there like, some female comedians are trying to get the thing and people would just torture them and make it so difficult. I go, how insecure are you that you got to go out of your way to bully somebody before they go on stage? I mean, it's like, you're not that.
Don Barris and some other guy, they were pushing the chairs forward so you have no walkway to go through. And he's very nervous. He don't like getting close to people.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, you know, I just.
Good jokes, though.
Just be nice. Just be kind. I mean, you know, the thing is, you see people like that, and you kind of heart breaks from it. I've been incredibly blessed in my life. You know, I go out of my way, and you know, I mean, you know, Bobby Lee. When Bobby Lee was working at the Comedy Store, he was coming up from San Diego and stuff. I saw him there one time. I stopped by the Comedy Store during a day for something, and I go, "Hey, he goes, man, anything to eat? 3 days, man." I grabbed him. I took him down to Carney's. I bought him a big freaking meal. I said, "Get what you want, dude, and I get something to go. Take it for later." I mean, I've been that guy. You know what that's like? I mean, I slept on the roof of the Comedy Store a couple nights. I had nowhere to go. I mean,
me and the Coyotes, you know?
Hey, dude, I'm not joking, man.
I slept with the stars.
Hey, I'll tell you something. It's one of my best nights of my life. I had a good night's sleep up there. A nice little nice little sleeping bag up there. Rolled up in the morning. good morning. That's all good, man. Yeah, but he was there when I was there. You know, there's people there, you know. Does he still there on Monday nights? He still come down?
Who, Robert Lee?
Yeah, Robert. No, I haven't seen him. William Abariah.
I haven't seen him.
Yeah. So, yeah, he used to come in and
I see Boom Shakalaka.
Who, Boom Shakalaka? There's a guy that looks like Jesus over there. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, there's a cast of crazy characters.
Apollo used to be crazy comedians, man.
Dude, I used to go back there back in the day. I mean, it would always bring out the crazies, man. It would always bring out the. I would say it'd be nice and just kind of do your thing and just kind of work around them. But I don't get involved with them because it always brings. I don't know what it is about comedy. It brings out crazy people and stand in line and get my big break in show business. guys been off his meds for 3 days. how many people are speaking through you right now, bro? How many people you got speaking through you? Stay with me. Stay on the. I'm going to talk you down. All right. Guys doing math equations. 2 + 2 = 7.
I'll talk you down.
That's just here. Here's a cup of coffee. Just relax. Everything's going to be fine.
Just relax.
guys got a fucking circus in his head. We're wrapping this thing up here.
Did you have to audition for Mitzi's too?
Yeah, I did a couple times actually.
How many times did you see you?
I had to go back like two or three times. Yeah, like I didn't get past the first time. I didn't get past the second time. I got the job as a doorman. I kind of helped, and then I started doing spots in the, like you get past enough to do spots in the belly room. And then I remember Arsenio brought me up in the main room. Just like he goes, "Hey, Jimmy, come on!" I had to do a set in the main room. I did my show, you know. So yeah, and then I kind of got, you know, everybody kind of took a leg into me. I got passed. But yeah, it took a while. It took a while to get, you know, and it should, you know, you shouldn't. I mean, I think a lot of comics nowadays, they develop in other cities, like they get, you know, Chicago, because you get more stage time there. I mean, stage time is incredibly tough to get out here in Los Angeles, and people don't realize, why would you come here and stay where you're at? Get good where you're at. Become the best comedian in Chicago or West Palm Beach or Fort Lauderdale.
Or Tampa.
Or Denver or Tampa. Become the best comedian.
Or Fresno.
In there. Yeah, become the best comedian in the city you live in first, and then bring all that with you to Los Angeles, because it's really, you know, get in a couple festivals, get some feedback, make some friends, figure. I mean, I think that's the way to do it now. You know, get invited to, like, you know, there's a ton of little festivals around there. So get in those festivals and maybe submit a tape for like somebody's late night. And then you're coming out with here with a little bit of, you get some heat on you, a little bit of heat, because you need a lot of heat. I mean, if you're coming out here with a million Vine followers, well, then you'll be fine.
Vine.
That's the advice I would say to people. People always, I think I'm ready to move. I said, well, you're working a role yet? I mean, go make a living where you're at first, and then kind of transfer it over to here. At least you can still make a living doing it. And, you know, kind of get your foot. I left L.A. after Sam died. And when I started to come back, I would come back for 2 weeks. And then I would leave and go back and do my job. And I would start do spots again and get my foot wet and just kind of. And then I kind of like slowly, I said, I'm not coming back to L.A. until I get a development deal, until I get a manager and an agent and all that stuff. And I went and I crashed Montreal. I crashed the Montreal Comedy Festival. And I wound up getting a pilot out of the deal, which was unheard of. And I also got a manager and an agent. I got a pilot, a manager, and an agent. And I wound up getting a development deal the following year. And I said, all right, that's it. I got to go back to L.A. I was living in Florida. And at the time, Florida was so much work in Florida. I mean, you could just literally drive that giant flaccid penis of a state and just work up. And there was like
other comedy zones.
Yeah, comedy zones. I mean, there was clubs from
Rascos.
From all the way down south, all the way up north, Jacksonville, Orlando had 4 clubs. Then if you went to the West Coast, St. Petersburg had like 4 or 5 rooms. I mean, I can tell.
Marco Island.
Fort Myers. Yeah, Sanibel.
Tallahassee.
I mean, you can make a living doing it. And that's really kind of where, like after I'd been doing stand-up, it's really kind of where I found my voice. I took a job as a house MC at a club called Haggerty's in Boca Raton, and I would up 6 nights a week down there. I would do 15 up front, and depending on how bad or good the middle act was, I'd do 20 in the middle. You basically were doing 45 minutes a night, you know, and that's where I really kind of found my voice, and then I went up and crashed Montreal, and then all that stuff happened. I moved back to Los Angeles.
What's up, fool, Rodrigo?
What's up, fool?
They're quiet.
What's up, fool?
Chilling, man. Fucking over here, fucking kicking it. What up with Philly? Was it rough growing up there?
Yeah.
He threw cars at people.
I mean, let me tell you something, bro. I used my fist so much as a kid. I was 5 before I realized I had fingers. Hey, kid, my grade school had a handgun vending machine. I had 6 brothers. I got more fist fights in my own house before I'm not kidding. I had 6 brothers. My old man was a homicide detective. I mean, Philly's a tough town, man. I mean, I got in fights every weekend. I mean, I had to fight my way out of Philly when I left. I had to fight your way out. It's a tough town. There are sections of Philadelphia, man. Well, you go, oh my God, I go back there now, like crack vials and hypodermic needles. And there's a section of K&A. It is one of the busiest freaking drug corner, like heroin now. I mean, like stuff. I mean, there are people there. Like, I was talking to my dad, there's cops. They do surveillance. They work for the vice squad. They said there's a mother daughter hooker team down there. Like there's people walking around. They are dead. They are zombies. They have just not fallen over yet. I mean, it's fucking bad in some certain areas. I mean, all along the East Coast, heroin is.
There's a lot of heroin in Pennsylvania.
Oh man.
I have a friend in Pennsylvania. Massachusetts. It is bad.
It is epidemic proportions. Yeah,
and, not in the news, but it's bad heroin.
Well,
problem.
You know, no one's reporting it, but it is epidemic levels, and people are losing their freaking children. And we're not talking about kids in bad neighborhoods. We're talking affluent kids.
That's the truth, bro.
And the people get hooked on, Percocet or Vicodin. It was in a car accident. I got a Vicodin. You get hooked on Vicodin. Next thing you know, you're doing oxys. And next thing you know, oxys are $30 a pill, and you're buying a 15 bag of heroin. And then they get clean, and then they relapse. And when you relapse, once you get clean from heroin, you can never shoot heroin again because you'll relapse. You'll die. And that's what happens. A lot of kids get clean. They relapse. Boom. I mean, there's one girl. I was just reading the story. The girl got in a car accident, died in a car accident. She still had a needle in her arm. She just shot up in the car while she's driving. Like, I mean, it's bad. It is bad. And I just and my old neighbor, $3.3 million worth of heroin seized, busted. They found out there's 3 stash houses. They got 68 people they locked up in a heroin drug thing. I mean, and the fact that you're not hearing this on evening news, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's bad. I mean, you look at a guy like Philip Seymour Hoffman. You would think, this guy has everything. This guy has everything. What would he worry about? I mean, for guys like me, if I had that career, I'd be the happiest, nicest, most professional motherfucker you ever met in your life. Hey, I'm off to do another fucking movie. Yeah, I'm doing what I love to do. And this guy's in the fucking bathroom, couldn't wait to fuck it up and shoot heroin, and he's got three little kids. I mean, I feel bad for his kids. I mean, they got to grow up without a dad, but there's a lot of people losing children. I mean, I see it, people that are in Philly on my Facebook feed, I see it all the time. And you would think, I mean, they better do something because this is fucking ridiculous. It is fucking ridiculous. War on fucking drugs, my ass. You better, well, you want to declare war on drugs, you declare war on drugs and get them off the fucking street. You take it, I mean, I used to, believe me, I used to party and all that stuff, but that shit is fucking evil, man. That is fucking devil shit right there. I mean, and I haven't done any of that stuff in a long time. I mean, occasionally I'll snap off a little piece of edible.
And have a glass. Little chip or two.
Have a little glass of wine.
I gotta tell you something though.
For me, it's like, you know, if you snap off a little piece of edible, you'd have no need for fucking antidepressants. I have a little piece of edible. I'm fucking zipping it, dude. My, what a wonderful day. Hey, zipping it, dude. I'm just kind of skipping my step. I'm laughing my balls off. I mean, try some of that before you get on Zoloft and Prozac. And edible, and there's no side effects. That's a beautiful thing. You know what I'm saying?
What's up, for Jimmy Schubert?
What's
in
up,
the house?
Here, Rodrigo. Yeah. What's up?
Got any dates you want to plug?
Man, just I got. Webpage? I'm doing the Addison Improv in September. I think the third week of September. I got some other stuff. Butch Bradley's doing a room in October and 9th and 10th. I'm doing Butch Bradley's. It's like a speakeasy comedy club. He just opened. You know Butch. He's doing a club down there. He just opened a club. It's a Friday, Saturday night in Atlantic City. Then I'm doing Rochester, New York. And then I just heard from my boy Vargas Mason. I'm getting ready to go do a European Armed Forces Entertainment Tour, which I'd love to do. I mean, if I have a good year and stuff, I'd love going and entertaining troops. For me, it's tough. Thanksgiving, I did Cuba, Honduras, El Salvador. I mean, unbelievable, dude. Releasing baby turtles on the beach in El Salvador. You had to wash your hands with the sand because you don't want to get because the turtles come back there 20 years and release their eggs on the same beach. So you're releasing baby turtles there. That was cool. Then I went zip line over to coffee trees. It's crazy. I love doing it. Because I travel so much, those trips for me are just for me. Like, I do Asia, man. You ever do Asia?
Never.
Ah, dude, we got to hook you up over there. You go over to Asia, you go Hong Kong, Shanghai, all American audience, Canadian, Australians, English speaking, Irish, and they're over there teaching English. Chinese, there's nothing for them to do. You would kill it over there, and you get the trip to Asia out of it. They fly you over, put you in some of the nicest hotels. You get to eat some exotic food and get to cross it off the bucket list. All right, I've been to Shanghai. But I do two international trips a year that are just for me because I do love traveling. I love seeing the world. And where else can you do that? I mean, that's one of the great things about being a stand-up comedian. You get to go and entertain people. I mean, Amsterdam does comedy. I mean, I think the internet's really kind of, I mean, when you go to Singapore, there's a comedy scene in Singapore. They do have an open mic night in Beijing. In Beijing, you go to the Bookworm, there's an open mic there, and you're going, this is ridiculous. Comedians are like cockroaches. All they need is a room with some microphones to do comedy anywhere, even if they're in a communist country. And you go to Singapore. Like Singapore, that's like some Lenny Bruce 1966 shit. Like if you, you know, like Bill Burr was talking, but like they say the wrong fucking thing, man. They go to jail. I mean, my buddy Matt Davis is over there now. He's in Indonesia. You're talking, it's like, it's not a joke. These guys, but it's kind of like, you know, like jazz music. Yeah. Stand-up comedy is a uniquely American art form. And the way we do it, it's really kind of a uniquely American art form. And so people want to see how it's done when you do it. And you get these great, amazing trips around the world to go do it. So. Anyway, I don't want to keep the podcast going. We're running out of time. Thanks for having me on What's Up, Fool?
Give us a yeah, man.
Yeah, man.
What's up, fool? August 14 and 15, I'll be in Salt Lake City. That's this week at West Valley, Utah at Wise Guys. Brea Improv, August 20 to 23rd. August 28, I'll be with Jimmy Schubert, Alonzo Bowden, That Fan at Harrah's Resort in Valley Center, California. It's the big building in the middle of nowhere. September 4th through the 6th, I'll be at San Jose Improv.
Nice.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, man.
Also, that's it, huh?
Well, I'm going to be in my kitchen, and when I open the refrigerator door, the light comes on, I'm going to do 15 minutes. Just kidding.
No. Jimmy Schumer from Philadelphia, baby.
Hell yeah.
What's up, fool?